This is Liberation Radio.
Capitalism needs poverty.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
Whatever we could do, we're gonna do, especially in continuing to preserve this earth.
Each week, we bring you interviews, commentary, analysis, political developments, and struggles affecting workers throughout the country as a way to build the movement for socialism in the United States.
The revolution will be broadcast.
The only thing that will ever defeat racism will be the defeat of its parents, capitalism and imperialism.
Without smashing mass incarceration, working people of all nationalities cannot have justice.
Liberation Radio is brought to you by the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Welcome to Liberation Radio. I'm your host, Sean Garcia. On this episode, we hear part two of the interview with Alexis Goldstein of Strike Debt, where she speaks about the growing movement to push back the largest debt of the land, U.S. student debt. But first, we speak with Walter Smarek, editor with Liberation News and member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. We speak about the Greek debt crisis and the people's movement to fight back against the austerity plan. All right, Walter, given that this is a pretty complex issue, could you first break down how much Greece owes in debt and who they owe it to?
Yeah, so Greece owes, a tremendous amount of money, approximately 170 to 180% of the size of the total economy. And this is owed to, right now, mostly central banks, so the National Bank of different countries inside the Eurozone, the group of countries that use the Euro common currency. So they used to be mostly owed to private big banks, but in 2012 there was an agreement where there was a so-called haircut where the private investors agreed to take a loss on their loans to Greece in return for Greece accepting, you know, another round of the devastating austerity. So, you know, it's important to understand that, you know, the bailout money isn't going to bail out the Greek people, it's going to bail out these big banks. So, you know, there's this narrative of the greedy Greek, the lazy Greek. But really, when Germany and other powerful Eurozone countries give money to the Greek banking system, really, they're just paying themselves and other capitalists.
Explain the impact of austerity and how it gave rise to the particular political climate with Syriza as the leading party.
Yeah, so I mean, the austerity has just been like absolutely devastating to the Greek working class. Unemployment stands at above 25%, and for young people, it's actually above 50%. There's massive homelessness, impoverishment, hunger. You know, sometimes they even have smog advisories in Athens because nobody can afford heating oil, and so people just burn wood to keep themselves warm. So, I mean, it's been absolutely horrifying. The economy has shrunk by one quarter since the crisis began. And so now, even after the Greek people have suffered so much, the big Eurozone countries, the Troika, which is the International Monetary Fund, the European Central Bank, and the European Union, want to impose even more of these measures that, in fact, end up deepening the crisis and pushing Greece further and further into debt. Because, of course, you know, when the economy is in such crisis, when it's contracting and nobody can spend any money, tax revenues go down and the Greek government's ability to pay likewise suffers. Oh, just to touch on the political aspect of this. So, you know, obviously people in Greece are desperate for any way to end this cycle of austerity and debt and economic crisis. So there are a number of forces on the left in Greece, but the one that was able to really rise to a position of national prominence to the point where now they're in charge of the government is Syriza, which is the coalition of the radical left. So it was initially a coalition of multiple different leftist organizations, some communist, some social democratic, and sort of everything in between. But after their sort of surprise second place showing in the elections in 2012, they unified into one sort of single party, although it has many different internal factions. So what Syriza promised was, first of all, they campaigned on the slogan of government of the left, meaning that Syriza, as well as other political parties, which at that time meant Democratic Left, which no longer really exists, and the Communist Party of Greece, would come together, form a government, and break with austerity and with the memorandum, which is, you know, the bailout agreements that they're compelled to sign. So in addition to that, they promised a series of social programs, which is sort of referred to as the Thessaloniki program, because that's the city where the leader of Syriza, Alexis Tsipras, was when he announced them. But it would relieve the most intense symptoms of the crisis, give free electricity and oil to the most needy Greek families, help young people find jobs, help people put food on the table. So, you know, it was a very popular program and something that resonated with the masses of Greek poor and working people.
And can you explain the current stage the negotiations are in?
Yeah, so this is actually possibly the most dramatic moment that these marathon negotiations have been leading up to. So the president of the European Commission, Donald Tusk, said that Sunday is the absolute deadline for Greece and its creditors, the Troika, to reach an agreement. If that doesn't happen, then it becomes very likely that Greece would actually have to exit the Eurozone, and provoking, you know, definitely a national economic crisis, but possibly a broader regional and even global economic crisis. No side of the recent referendum was victorious in a landslide. People said no to the Troika's proposal, which included much more austerity. And now the Greek government is trying to leverage that referendum result to get preferential terms from the creditors. Although it should be noted that the most recent proposal that was just sent tonight by the Greek government actually includes most of the terms that were rejected by Greek voters in the referendum. And so it appears that there's sort of a last-ditch effort by the Greek government to offer major concessions in order to remain part of the Eurozone and sort of meet the Troika's core demands.
If Syriza got a mandate in the referendum to oppose a deal, why is Tsipras going forward now with a seemingly contradictory plan?
Well, during the election campaign, Syriza made two core promises, one to break with austerity and the other to keep Greece in the Eurozone. And these are two very contradictory things, because Greece's ability to continue being a member of the common currency of the Eurozone is really contingent on their ability to convince the Troika that they should be allowed to do so, or that they should continue to receive bailout money, which, again, just goes right back into the big bank's pocket. So these negotiations, what they argued is that, you know, the political fallout from a country leaving the Eurozone, which has never happened before, that prospect would be so great that the Troika would immediately, you know, come to their senses and agree to what Syriza leadership has termed an honorable compromise, where, you know, some austerity is imposed, which is a violation already of their first election promise, but, you know, a tolerable amount which allows Greece to remain part of the Eurozone. So it appears that their promise to keep Greece inside the Eurozone is overriding their commitment to break with austerity entirely. So, of course, you know, like I said before, there's many different internal factions inside Syriza, and it appears that this is going to be a highly controversial thing if the Troika does, in fact, accept this very latest counterproposal that does include a tremendous amount of austerity. So it really remains to be seen which one of these two mandates that Syriza will stick to, because it becomes, as it becomes increasingly clear that fulfilling both keeping Greece in the Eurozone and breaking the austerity is impossible on a fundamental level.
What are the prospects of a deal passing in the parliament?
Well, it appears at this point to be pretty good, although whether or not the government will survive a vote in parliament is less clear. So the main opposition parties have been meeting recently. The president of Greece, which is a largely ceremonial position, convoked a meeting of all the different political party leaders, and with the exception of the Communist Party, which did not attend. And they, you know, issued the statement saying, you know, we support the national efforts to negotiate a deal, and basically just telegraphing to the Troika that, you know, there would be the votes in Parliament to pass this law, or to pass a new deal. But there's a significant section of Syriza, which is called the Left Platform, which, you know, has anywhere between 30 and 45% support within the actual party structure of Syriza, would likely try to block a deal. And, you know, it's unclear if they would vote no, if they would abstain, if people would even go so far as to resign from the party. But there's been strong signals by the Left Platform, including the leader of the Left Platform, who is the minister for energy and productive reconstruction, that, you know, there would be a significant fight put up by the left wing of Syriza if this is in fact the deal that they go forward with.
Mm. And can you give a general sketch of the approach of the non-Syriza left to the current negotiations?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, the major force to the left of Syriza is the Communist Party of Greece. And they have, you know, a very long history of struggle in Greece. There is even a civil war right after World War II where they came close to seizing power. But they've adopted essentially an abstentionist position on this issue, meaning that, you know, they put forward a revolutionary program. They call for the socialist transformation of society, seizing all the means of production, leaving the, you know, not just the Eurozone, but the European Union itself, as well as NATO. But unfortunately, in terms of their actual intervention, they have not prioritized reaching out to this growing mass of people who are sincere in their desire for the Greek government, for the Syriza-led government, to succeed in the negotiations with the Troika, because they see the possibility, you know, the first time in many, many years, a glimmer of hope to break with the policies that have destroyed their lives. And so Syriza offered to form a coalition government with the Communist Party of Greece, but they wouldn't even meet with Syriza. In fact, they, you know, just have basically contented themselves with issuing, you know, proclamations, doing, you know, mobilizing their own base, but not really going outside of that very far. And in the referendum against austerity, instead of urging a no vote, they actually, you know, in a very vague way, encourage their supporters to spoil their ballot. So it's unfortunately a very significant lost resource to the Greek working class that they're deprived of, you know, the experienced cadre in revolutionary history of the Communist Party of Greece at this crucial moment. It's also important to note when we're talking about, you know, just the left in general, that the mass movement that emerged in the week prior to the referendum, I mean, we saw, you know, possibly the biggest demonstration since the crisis started 2 days before the vote. That mass movement, while it's supportive of the government, has the potential to go far beyond the government's program and can become really an independent force to change society.
Mm. And so what are some key events that we should be keeping our eye on?
Well, so on Sunday, there's a meeting of the heads of state and government of the Eurozone countries. And it seems like that's really, you know, the zero hour, if you will, for the negotiations, where, you know, there will be a clear proposal from Greece and they'll decide whether or not to accept it. There is a very large payment to the European Central Bank due on July 20th, so a week from Monday. And if Greece doesn't pay that payment, it's likely that they'll sort of be considered to be, you know, officially bankrupt, officially in default. They've already missed a payment on June 30th to the International Monetary Fund, but because of legal technicalities of how, you know, contracts and different services and financial packages are presented, that doesn't count as a default in the sense that it would trigger these things called credit default swaps, which, you know, are what could really destabilize the region one world economy. So July 20th is sort of default date. After that, it's, you know, totally unexplored territory. But Sunday, in terms of the political resolution of a crisis, is going to be crucial at that heads of state and government meeting.
Well, thanks so much, Walter.
Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. And fraud, I mean, is this, because I think the way it's often painted is that this is something that is, you know, extremely rare, that would never happen. Have you been able to get any indications that, or have you seen any indication either way, I guess, that the Corinthian piece was something of a one-off, or is something that could be significantly much more widespread?
I think it's much more widespread, particularly in the for-profit college industry. The for-profit college industry has been criticized for many years, mostly by Democrats, but Democrats certainly take their money a lot of the time too. But they've been universally defended by Republicans. They represent about a quarter of all federal student loan money goes to for-profit schools. And for-profit schools can get up to 90% of their tuition from federal student loans. So really all it is a scam to siphon taxpayer money into a school that then gives people a piece of paper diploma that's totally worthless. So the kind of fraud that we've seen at Corinthian, there are similar amounts of investigations and lawsuits against ITT Tech, which is another for-profit school, the Art Institute, a number of different, like, cooking schools, like Le Cordon Bleu.
This is like every commercial that I see.
Right. So it seems incredibly widespread across the for-profit sector. But, you know, I'm sure that it's present in the public sector as well. But I think it's particularly concentrated at these for-profit schools.
And so I just want to pivot, because you spoke to this in terms of the debt strike at Corinthian. I want to talk about the issue of debt resistance. And before we do that, though, I just want to frame this a little bit, because you had mentioned the issue of free higher education. And I know that you guys have done some research into that as well. So I wanted you to speak to not just the moral principle of free higher education, but the actual possibility of putting something like that in place.
So if you go to, let me just make sure I get the URL right. If you go to strikedebt.org, how far to free, but the words are separated by hyphens, we have a white paper. So everything I'm talking about, if you want to look at more details, you can check out strikedebt.org/how-far-to hyphen free. So public higher education in this country, and by that I mean two-year and four-year public schools, take in about a little less than $70 billion a year worth of tuition and fees. And we basically have this proposal that says if we stopped giving money to for-profit schools, if we stopped giving people tax breaks for paying interest on their student loans, and if we redirected some other existing subsidies for higher education and put them all into directly funding free public higher education, that would get us almost all of the way there, and we would need about $15 billion extra per year, and we could make public higher education free in this country. And just to be clear, public higher education, right? So not Harvard, not private schools, but you know, the state schools and other public institutions, community colleges, things like that.
I should add, the vast majority of students who are in higher education attend, correct?
Yes. And another sort of point that we like to bring up when we talk about, oh, well, but it's so hard to get the government to spend any new money, even if it's just $15 billion a year, how could we pay for it? the government makes money on its student loan program. And the estimates vary, but the most recent estimate of how much money the government is projected to make is $53 billion in total over the next 10 years in profits off of managing a student loan portfolio. And if you look at just how much the government is supposed to make in profits this year, the estimate is $4.5 billion. Now, so that's not all the way to $15 billion, but it's some of the way. And so that is our proposal, is essentially, if we want to, you know, you hear people talk a lot about how important education is, right? You hear people say, oh, it's the civil rights issue of our time, or it's the way that you can break into the middle class. And there are all of these promises that people make. And then you have these for-profit schools taking advantage of people who believe things like that. So if we really believe it and our politicians really want to say things like that, they need to start, you know, putting their money where their mouth is. And so that's part of what the proposal is about.
Absolutely. And I think that from that sort of, so with that context, now that we know that college could, of course, be free, and we certainly agree here at Liberation Radio, education is a human right, that now the issue of debt becomes an issue around which people are organizing, and you spoke to the debt strike. I wonder if you could just speak in general to the concept that I've seen the Debt Collective and the Strike Debt Project raise, which is debt resistance. What is it? What's the underpinning of it? What are you hoping to achieve?
So I think the best way to summarize it is included on the website. If you just go to debtcollective.org, you'll see this header that says, you know, if you owe the bank $1,000, the bank owns you. If you owe the bank $1 trillion, you owe the bank. Together, we own the bank. And so the basic idea is, if we all joined together said we are going to refuse to pay our debt, we all of a sudden would have a huge amount of collective power, and we would be able to negotiate in a way that we cannot as individuals alone. So the idea is really to build a debtors union, much in the way that unions can work to negotiate and get better conditions for workers. The Debt Collective's assessment is that debt is one of the things that binds the 99% together. And debt is also the way that Wall Street occupies our lives, right? Because they lobby, they cut social programs, they cut, you know, the safety net, and they force us essentially to go into debt because the government continues to shrink. And so we're saying, instead of just accepting that and taking what corporations try to make into a morality play, and it's never a morality play, you'll notice, when it's a corporation going bankrupt, right? It's just, oh, we're restructuring, we need to start over, we need to start fresh. But when people can't pay their loans, all of a sudden there's some moral argument to be made. And so we're trying to encourage people to rethink that, to reject it, and to recognize that, you know, we are not loans, and you are not a loan. But that if we work together and can build a union of debtors, we could build collective power. And one of the tactics for doing that is this idea of debt refusal and debt resistance. But I think because the United States is so punitive in the way that it punishes people who refuse to pay their student loans, we have to do it together. Because any one person doing it individually, you know, the government can garnish your wages. They can take your Social Security. They can take your disability. And so what we tried to prove with this first test case with the Corinthian students is, let's do it together. And that way we can be more effective and we can help protect each other as we wage this fight.
And I just wonder if you speak, and this is a little bit off of what you spoke of before, is what is the sort of the moral underpinning of this? Is it really just an issue of, well, the debt was given to us falsely, or is there something in general that you feel is negative about education as a commodity?
Well, I think it's both and. I think a lot of debt is illegitimate. There are a number of students at Corinthian who had debt taken out by the school without their knowledge. But I also think that it goes back to what I was saying before about how a lot of people are forced into debt now to meet basic needs. And it's our assessment that we shouldn't need to go into debt to meet basic needs like housing or to get an education, which is something that our society holds out as this great promise to solve all of our problems and launch us into, you know, out of whatever income bracket we're in now and into another one. And so if that's really true, then we, again, shouldn't force people into debt to get this thing that is so highly valued by society. But also, we shouldn't treat people that have student student debt more punitively than we treat any other form of debt, which is what we do right now. If you take out a loan to pay your gambling debts, you can declare bankruptcy, but you cannot declare bankruptcy on your student debt, which you took out to pursue an education. So there's some sort of, I suppose, reforms that you could do at the margins, but we're really trying to do, you know, a full-scale revolution and bring about, you know, tuition-free public higher education.
And for all those who are listening here in Liberation Radio who want to join you in that full-scale revolution, how would they get in contact with you guys?
So the best way to reach us is just to check out our website. It is debtcollective.org. And if you scroll down, you can, if you happen to have Navient student loans, for example, you can sign up to be a part of the Navient Collective or the Sallie Mae Collective or the Nelnet Collective. So that's the best place to go is debtcollective.org.
And once again, we were joined by Alexis Goldstein here today on Liberation Radio, who is an organizer with the Debt Collective. Alexis, thank you so much for joining us.
Eugene, thank you so much for having me.
That's all for Liberation Radio. I'm Sean Garcia. Please remember this program is available free for broadcast by community and public radio stations. You can encourage your local radio station to air Liberation Radio. They can visit liberationradio.org for details. Tune in next week for more from the Struggle for Justice.
You have been listening to Liberation Radio, a weekly program from the Party for Socialism and Liberation. You can find us online at liberationradio.org to listen to past shows and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Some of what you heard during this program are Creative Commons licensed compositions. Our theme music and some music segments were performed by Six Fingers and used with permission of the artists. Liberation Radio is produced by the Party for Socialism and Liberation to help build the struggle for socialism in the United States. The PSL is a party of activists and organizers. We are in the streets at the demonstrations and picket lines, opposing cutbacks and attacks on workers, standing up to police brutality, fighting for immigrant rights, and struggling against racism, sexism, homophobia, and all forms of bigotry. We stand in solidarity with oppressed peoples around the world resisting imperialism. We believe the crimes of capitalism call for a new kind of society, and we are committed to fighting for it. To find a PSL branch near you, see our upcoming events and learn more about how you can get involved. PSLweb.org. Again, that's PSLweb.org. Also, the PSL's Liberation newspaper online at liberationnews.org, where you can read our news articles and analysis or purchase a subscription to the print edition. Thank you for listening.